This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Saturday welcomed the U.S. decision to terminate strict parole conditions on convicted spy Jonathan Pollard. Pollard is an American jailed in the U.S. in 1985 for spying for Israel. A statement from the Prime Minister's office also said that Netanyahu hopes Pollard will arrive in Israel soon. Pollard served 30 years in prison for giving away classified U.S. documents and had been confined by parole terms to the U.S. since his release in 2015, despite Israeli pressure to allow him to leave. The U.S. Justice Department said on Friday it had removed those conditions. He was a U.S. Navy intelligence analyst in the mid-1980s when he made contact with an Israeli colonel in New York and began sending U.S. secrets to Israel in exchange for tens of thousands of dollars. Israel's October 1985 raid on the Palestinian Liberation Organization's Tunis headquarters that killed around 60 people was planned with information from Pollard, according to CIA documents declassified in 2012. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met Afghan government and Taliban negotiators in the Qatari capital, Doha, Saturday. But there was no announcement of any breakthrough as Washington accelerates its military withdrawal from Afghanistan. Pompeo's visit came in the wake of a rocket attack which struck densely populated areas of Kabul, killing at least 8 people in the latest outbreak of violence in the Afghan capital. The Taliban denied responsibility, and the Islamic State group claimed the deadly strike. Doha is the Taliban's base for diplomacy. Pompeo heads next to Abu Dhabi for another leg of his 7-nation tour of Europe and the Middle East as President Donald Trump shores up late-term priorities. This is VOA News. Archaeologists have discovered the exceptionally well-preserved remains of 2 men scalded to death by the volcanic eruption that destroyed the ancient Roman city of Pompeii in 79 AD. This is what the Italian Culture Ministry said on Saturday. One was probably a man of high status, the other a slave. Pompeii was home to about 13,000 people when the eruption buried it under ashes, pebble, and dust and froze it in time. Here are some of the latest developments now in the global coronavirus crisis. U.S. biotech giant Pfizer and German partner BioNTech are seeking approval to roll out their coronavirus vaccine early, a first step towards relief as surging infections prompt a return to shutdown that traumatized nations and the global economy earlier this year. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, says its vaccines committee will meet on December 10th to discuss the request for emergency use authorization. Russia registers record numbers for daily infections and deaths from the coronavirus 2 days after having passed 2 million cases. Health officials reported over 24,800 new infections and 476 deaths, bringing the national total to over 2.6 million cases and more than 35,700 fatalities since the beginning of the year. Meantime, Russian President Vladimir Putin told G20 leaders on Saturday that Russia was ready to provide its Sputnik V coronavirus vaccine to other countries who need it. Russia is also preparing its second and third vaccine, Putin said, adding that the creation of a vaccine portfolio was a common goal. France is preparing to reopen stores for the crucial Christmas shopping season, encouraged by new data suggesting the country is past the worst of its second wave of infections. Thanks to curfews and partial lockdowns, confirmed new infections dropped by 40% last week. Admissions to hospitals fell by 13%, and the number of new intensive care patients was down by 9%, according to the National Health Agency. Blue skies over the Matterhorn drew skiers and snowboarders to Zermatt on Saturday, as well as police to break up crowds. This as Switzerland's modest coronavirus restrictions allowed near normal operations. But France, Italy, Austria, and Germany have all ordered the high altitude lifts that could be running this early in the season to remain closed for now, in the hope that all resorts can benefit at peak season if and when the infection rate slows. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator is Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Thanks for joining us. Here are the issues. The coronavirus pandemic spirals out of control. Some good news as several highly effective vaccines appear to be within reach. And more than 2 weeks after the U.S. presidential election, President Trump continues to claim widespread fraud without evidence. Plus, the U.S. is set to draw down troops from the Middle East. What will that mean for U.S. national security and for that region? Tom, Abrahim, it's good to talk to both of you again, and we have a lot to talk about for this week's news. Let's start with the pandemic. It's been 8 months. It's clearly not going away. The numbers in the U.S., over 250,000 people have now died. That is a quarter of a million people. And you're seeing record new number of cases in recent days. States are now considering a second round of lockdowns. Tom, how did we get here?
Well, to be very blunt about it, I think because a lot of people in America just decided that wearing a mask was not necessary. And many millions of people in many states just stopped social distancing. Now, we keep seeing on the internet these pictures of parties with 50 or 100 or many other people drinking and having a great time, not wearing masks. And I think there has been far greater transmission than we've seen for 6 months. I think a lot of people believe President Trump when he said we're rounding a corner. All the data shows that at the moment, very sadly, we're not rounding a corner.
Yeah, the president is claiming, though, that he has done a lot and that there would be many more lives lost without his leadership. But a lot of people are asking, where is he right now? He seems to have sort of disappeared, even as the number of cases go up and up, and we've now hit this really awful milestone of 250,000 deaths. We haven't really been hearing, Abraham, much from the president on the pandemic.
No, we have not. I always say that I've been in the United States now for 20 years. And obviously, this country has gone through many different crises and shenanigans and has always been able to land on the right side of finding a solution to move on. But I've never seen anything like this in terms of the shenanigans going on about the result of the election and what that means for the pandemic. I mean, it was expected over the spring that come the summer, the pandemic would alleviate. That didn't happen. Then people were saying, well, maybe in the fall, things may get better. And that didn't happen. But we haven't heard, as you said, much from President Trump, because it seems to me that he's so preoccupied with the election situation and the shenanigans over the result of it with Joe Biden. But Joe Biden, it has to be said, especially over the last couple of days, he seems, without, you know, angling this in any way which may be seen as cynical, he seems to have found a way to actually consolidate his position a little bit in terms of warning Americans that unless he starts getting the information he needs to get from the Trump team, the impact of the pandemic in the United States is going to get a lot worse.
I'm going to just stop you there because we're going to talk about the transition and the hiccups there for our next topic. But certainly you are hearing complaints from the Biden team that because they're not officially certified by the obscure federal agency that does that, they're not getting access to the coronavirus task force, the data there, the resources the U.S. has. And so that when they do come into office, presumably January 20th, they're not going to be able to have all of this time to have been working on trying to get the country in a better shape for the pandemic. But we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. Tom, I want to go back to you about this idea of pandemic fatigue. We do have these two vaccines that appear to be highly effective that could possibly end the pandemic from Pfizer and Moderna. And there's a third one from another big pharma company. But we're also being told by public health experts that it's going to be months until these vaccines are widely distributed. So what do you think that's going to do to the American psyche? Is that going to sort of tell people, hold on and you know, stay safe until we get there? Or is it going to do the opposite? It will discourage people from taking more precautions because they feel like this is almost over.
Well, I think there's going to be some of both of that. I think there is incredible pandemic fatigue, and this is good news. Even health experts who have been critical of President Trump handling of all of this are saying this is the closest we're going to get to a gold standard of vaccine and testing, but it's going to take a while. I mean, unless you're a first responder or a healthcare professional, you may not be able to get the vaccine for several months. I'm hoping that more Americans will decide to rally around the notion that help is on the way and we can hold on for a couple more months and then we'll have vaccines. On the other hand, there are so many people out there who spurn masks. All the experts say that masks will stop the transmission or at least limit it significantly, and there are millions of people who don't believe that. It's troubling. I wish we had somebody in a position of leadership to say to the country, listen, ladies and gentlemen, here is the deal. If you don't wear your mask, somebody's going to die. It may not be you, but it might be a family member. It might be your grandmother or your grandfather or your aunt or your uncle, but somebody will die. I don't believe it's registering to the degree that it should.
Or that it did in the spring when this all started and people seem to really be paying a lot more attention. And as you said, the months have been dragging on. And even though hospitals are now feeling overwhelmed by the amount of cases, people just don't seem to be focused on this. There are other things going on, certainly the election we'll talk about. But yeah, you mentioned the critics are saying President Trump's sort of flip-flopping on masks and wearing the masks has not helped. But then you have in California now, the governor of California, a Democrat, he's in a lot of hot water because there are pictures coming out. He was at a dinner party, no masks, no social distancing, and he's been telling people in his state, you have to be careful, don't gather for Thanksgiving, you need to be wearing masks, and he's not practicing what he preaches. So there's certainly mixed messages coming from a lot of areas and from different parties in this country. But I want to get a sense of what's going on around the world, Ebrahim, and I want to bring you in on this. Give us sort of the global snapshot of what's going on in Europe right now. They're dealing with another surge. Iran is facing its worst COVID outbreak yet. What steps are other countries taking? And the big question, like we're seeing here, are other people in other countries listening to their leaders?
It seems that there's a second wave, a second surge of pandemic happening in pretty much everywhere, a lot of places in Europe, as you mentioned, in Africa, other parts. Africa seems to be the surprise of the season, if I may call it that, because the norm has been, at least in the Western media, to say, you know, as far as pandemics and diseases, Africa is always ranks at the top, except that this time Africa seems to be doing quite well, at least in comparison with other parts of the world, including the United States. And that's a result of how various African countries have worked very closely together throughout the pandemic. You know, the result now is, at least now, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, but at least now the Africans seem to have a better handle on the pandemic than the Americans or even the Europeans. The Europeans, in terms of the reactions of the governments in Europe, there was a lot of concern, obviously, during the first wave. We've seen horrendous numbers in countries like Italy, for example, is really battered by the pandemic. But this time around, governments seem to have rallied around the idea that they have to work together and extend financial help to Europeans. You have countries like Germany, a powerful, rich country. You have even less rich countries such as Greece, basically helping companies, helping ordinary citizens financially to deal with the impact of the second wave. And that seems to have created a lot of, if you may call it, satisfaction among the people in Europe vis-a-vis what their governments are trying to do.
That's a really good sort of point to jump on, the economic fallout and what countries are doing to help people who are struggling financially. Let's talk here, Tom. So Congress pumped trillions of dollars into the economy, but they seem to be stuck on the next relief bill. How far apart are the Democrats and Republicans, and any chance something gets done before the new year?
Well, I hope so, Shana, but it doesn't look like it at the moment. They're not talking. The Democrats and the Republicans in Congress are about $1 to $2 trillion apart. And you get the feeling that especially the Senate Republicans have dug in their heels, are not going to support that kind of a figure. You would think that the country's legislative leaders would get together and say, we have to do something of an interim nature right now before the end of the year. And at the moment, they're not interested in doing that. And, you know, people are dying, people are out of work, people are literally going hungry. And it's, it just seems to be a very callous game here. But everything is more or less tied up with the election results. And the end result of that is that Congress is paralyzed at the moment. It seems astonishing, but they are paralyzed at the moment.
Republicans will say they want to pass a skinny bill that's more targeted, and the Democrats are countering that a lot of money has to be thrown at this problem, and there are a lot of political fights going on right now and back and forth. But as you say, meanwhile, people are really struggling. People are dying and people are losing jobs. It's a very big problem, especially for local governments who need extra help to deal with this crisis as well. And this is not a problem that's going to go away. I'm certain we're going to continue talking about that. Let's go to a break. And when we pick up from the break, we'll talk about the election, the results, and the transition, which both of you have mentioned. It's a big story. Let's get on to it.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back. It has been more than 2 weeks since the U.S. election, and President Trump still refuses to admit defeat, even though major news organizations have declared Joe Biden the winner based on ballot counts in key swing states. The president and his allies continue to try and overturn the results of the election, but their legal challenges aren't going so well. In fact, they've lost nearly every legal challenge so far. Abraham, they seem to be having difficulty proving this widespread fraud.
They do. And as you said, they've tried different avenues in different states, which would be important to the overall result. But so far, those haven't panned out in any significant ways. They may be able to change the count by a few hundred here, even a few thousand there, but that's not going to impact the overall result, which is that Joe Biden has carried this election. But, you know, if you wanted to be a little bit charitable to Trump, it has to be given to Trump and to his camp that they're not giving up. I mean, they're coming under intense pressure from the Biden camp, from even some of the Republicans in Congress and elsewhere, but they seem to be determined to continue. We don't know exactly what the end game for President Trump is. So far, he hasn't caved into pressure. And also have to say that that's obviously raising concerns for many Americans about what that may mean for the democratic system in the United States and more immediately for the national security of the United States.
We'll get to the national security implications in a moment, and that's a really good point. But to Abraham's other point, what does it mean for the democracy when you have, Tom, new polls showing that at least half of Republican voters believe this election was rigged? They believe President Trump here, even if there's so much evidence to counter that.
This is very bad for democracy, Shayna. And let me remind listeners, President Trump is the 10th president I've covered. I started covering the White House in the last months of the Lyndon Johnson administration. So I've got some institutional memory here and institutional history. And I can tell you that none of the presidential transitions since Lyndon Johnson have been as contentious and as challenged and as contested as this, except for Bush versus Gore, but that was a legal challenge over a handful of votes in Florida. I can remember that when Jimmy Carter lost to Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter not only called to concede that night, but he promised President Reagan this will be the greatest, most successful transition in history. And every president who has lost a re-election, and all there was a transition between all of those presidents, and they all were relatively okay. But you've never had a situation, in my experience, where millions and millions and millions of Americans, mainly Trump supporters, believe that the election was stolen. And there is no evidence of that, but these are people who will not be deterred in that belief. And that is fundamentally bad for democracy. It's really bad also that the transition work has not been allowed to go forward because President Trump has said no transition until we get this sorted out.
even if President Trump does concede defeat, I mean, he's still going to be a major figure in the Republican Party, especially if he does decide or if he insists that he's going to run in 2024. Is that, Abraham, why you think we're seeing many Republicans, although some have sort of admitted that Joe Biden won, but we're seeing congressional leadership like Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, not saying that Biden won because they don't want to get in President Trump's sort of crosshairs?
Possibly, but you'll have to remember that among the very many unprecedented things about the 2020 election, I would defer to Tom, obviously, in terms of his knowledge of previous administrations and how they've conducted themselves in transitions and during their administrations. But I don't think Americans have ever seen anything like President Donald Trump, both in terms of him saying what he thinks without worrying too much about being politically correct, but also in terms of the base that he's cultivated. They seem to believe in him and they seem to believe what he says through thick and thin. I mean, it's probably another instance of unprecedented that you have a president of the United States who was defeated in the election, even after about 70 million Americans have voted for him. And probably not all of those 70 million are his base. So he will continue to wield a lot of influence. Whether that's the reason why many Republicans are reluctant to say to him bluntly, you've lost, you need to move on and concede so that Joe Biden can become the legitimate president of the United States. But regardless whether he runs in 2024 or he doesn't, I think the base is here, his legacy is here, whether he disappears after this election or he stays. It becomes a huge challenge for Joe Biden to try and build bridges with the current base of President Trump, not just in terms of economic policy, but, you know, even in terms of science. This whole issue that President Trump has instigated among his base, that, you know, they don't have to wear a mask and that the pandemic may not necessarily be real, that's going to be a major challenge for Joe Biden moving forward. And maybe even in the election in 2024, people will continue to contend with this unprecedented polarization which currently exists in the United States.
It's a very big problem, and it's a good point that it's not only an issue of just unifying the country in general, but also around this issue of defeating the pandemic, or at least bringing the numbers down and getting everyone on the same page on the science. The other issue, Tom, is that there are many Republicans who feel like the Democrats have vilified them. And so there's a lot of just distrust and conflict on every side here in this country. It's going to be a big challenge to Joe Biden going forward. What are some of the other domestic issues Biden may face once he comes into office January 20th, Tom?
His immigration policy. He wants to roll back Trump's view of immigration. He wants to stop construction on the wall along the southern border with Mexico. He wants to raise taxes on wealthy Americans. The other one I would say is climate change and environmental issues. He wants to roll back many of President Trump's initiatives in this area. And a lot of Republicans in Congress don't want him to do that. So he's not going to be able to do as many things as he had hoped he would be able to do.
Yeah, and certainly, as you point out, it's going to be much more difficult for him because the Democrats lost seats in the House. So they have a majority there, but it's a smaller majority. And they thought they were going to sweep the Senate. And that certainly didn't happen. Plus, you have the Democrats. There's infighting there between progressives and centrists. So Biden is going to face challenges not only from the Republicans, but from his own party. And then on the foreign policy front, Abdulrahim, I want to bring you in. What kind of challenges does Joe Biden face there?
Let me first of all say one theoretical challenge, which is the fact that it has to do with U.S. democracy, the way it's constructed. The president of the United States occupies an extremely powerful position, despite all the checks and balances of the U.S. political system. He can introduce change. He can change policies, the policies adopted by his predecessor, and that's his prerogative and so on and so forth. But one challenge that he will face, let's take the Iran deal. Obama basically concluded that deal together with U.S. allies, with the Iranians. Then came President Trump, and he basically trashed it. And the issue for Biden will become, with other countries looking at that and saying, well, you know, if I conclude a deal with the Biden administration now, what guarantee do I have that that the next administration will uphold and preserve that deal. So that's one challenge. But there are other challenges in terms of the policy with Iran itself. Biden is likely to want to bring back some aspects of the Iranian nuclear deal with Tehran. Obviously, President Donald Trump has made it very difficult for him to do that, but there, he still has a margin of maneuver. There's the issue of Israel and Palestine. President Donald Trump has basically taken U.S. policy in an unprecedented direction by moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Obviously, Biden, I do not see how he can try to reverse that. He may want to go back to the two-state solution for which many people in the U.S., including many Jewish Americans, are clamoring because they're worried about the future of Israel as a Jewish state. China, I don't see how Biden's policy could be very different from Trump's policy, except that Biden will probably be a little bit better spoken about China, but the crux of the policy and the challenges that come with that policy will probably remain the same.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in your answer, and certainly on China, we are seeing a hardening of rhetoric coming from both parties. So as you say, it doesn't seem like a lot will change there. And then with the Palestinian-Israel issue, so much has changed on the ground with Gulf states now normalizing relations with Israel, something that even some of the Democrats are praising. And then lastly, on the Iran deal, you know, Biden has said the U.S. would come back to the deal if Iran came back into compliance, but Iran continues to breach the deal. And plenty of critics of the deal, including some Democrats, believe the deal didn't go far enough to address Iran's other malign activities in the region, like funding terrorist groups and developing ballistic missiles. So this is not easy. This is going to be very complicated for Joe Biden. I want to stay in the Middle East because the U.S. this week announced that they are going to be withdrawing additional troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. You had the acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, announcing the U.S. is going to pull more troops from those countries, leaving around 2,500 in each country, down from 4,500 in Afghanistan, 3,000 in Iraq. This is all supposed to take place in mid-January, so just days before Biden gets into office. Tom, this is something, though, that President Trump has promised since his 2016 campaign, that he's going to be pulling troops out of the Middle East, getting the U.S. out of forever wars. So is this much of a surprise?
No, it's not that much of a surprise, except for the fact that his Joint Chiefs of Staff, his military leaders, and his civilian Pentagon leaders all opposed this. And the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, sent a classified message recently to the White House saying this is a bad idea. So what happened? He was fired by President Trump, and we now have an acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, who will be there no longer than 8 weeks, the maximum. So it's not surprising that Trump did this. It's a little surprising that the president essentially ignored his entire military and defense chain of command, which he, of course, has every right to do. But whatever else it means, is it means there's going to be turmoil in our policy in the Middle East. Of course, it raises the question of whether the remaining 2,500 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan are enough to do the job.
And Abraham, I'll let you have the last word here. What are regional players saying about this withdrawal and U.S. allies?
There is concern, first of all, about the withdrawal from Afghanistan. There's concern from the Afghan government itself. There's concern from some of the U.S. allies. There's concern from NATO that the time is not really right for withdrawing from Afghanistan. Many of these countries are pointing out that the Taliban continues to launch, and even President Trump's critics here in the United States are continuing to point out that the Taliban continues its attacks in Afghanistan. The time may not be right. Ditto for Iraq. There's a lot of concern. The green zone in Baghdad, which is the most important part of Baghdad, where the U.S. embassy is housed, came under attack in recent days. So a lot of people are cautioning that the timing may not be right. But I just want to say this to conclude, especially about Iraq. There will continue to be discussion about whether the U.S. should be militarily in Iraq or not. Whether you agree with it or not, there is absolutely no way for me that the U.S. can completely withdraw from Iraq, because Iraq is so central to U.S. strategic interests at this point in history.
Yeah, this is going to be certainly another challenge that the Biden team is going to have to contend with once they get into office. And that is all the time we have. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fakara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas. Great analysis from both of you. I really appreciate it. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver, Jill Robbins, and Greg Stockel. We close our program with the American story, A Piece of Red Calico, by Frank Stockton. But first, the town of Rehoboth Beach in the American state of Delaware is known for big waves, sweet treats like saltwater taffy, and a long wooden boardwalk next to the ocean that dates back to the 1870s. It has long called itself the nation's summer capital. Soon, it can say it is home away from home for the 46th president of the United States. President-elect Joe Biden owns a home just blocks away from the beach in Rehoboth. It takes about 2 hours to get to Rehoboth from Washington, D.C., and a bit under 2 hours from Biden's longtime home near Wilmington, Delaware. Rehoboth only has about 1,500 full-time residents, but its population grows to about 25,000 during the summer months. Before the coronavirus pandemic, events like Independence Day weekend and the yearly Sea Witch Festival in October would draw up to 80,000 visitors. Movie stars Richard Gere and Denzel Washington are known to visit Rehoboth Beach, but Biden would be the first president to vacation regularly in the beach town. The changes in Rehoboth are already happening. Biden spent time in Rehoboth Beach after the Democratic National Convention this summer. He returned last weekend, days after being projected the winner of the 2020 presidential election. The area around Biden's home is restricted, but reporters arrived in Rehoboth Beach last weekend anyway. Television journalists gathered at the boardwalk to get a good filming spot. The Browse About bookstore in Rehoboth set up a special area with books about Biden, as well as books that Joe and Jill Biden have written. The area also included things like Biden calendars, cups, coloring books, jewelry, and footwear. The top seller was a special candle that smells like one of Biden's favorite drinks, orange Gatorade. After he left the vice presidency, Biden would sometimes come to Browse About bookstore to buy coffee and a newspaper after his Sunday religious service. The treatment that they get is the same as everybody. We want everybody to feel welcome, bookstore worker Jesse Jones said of the Bidens. There was definitely a high energy today, Jones added, as word spread that Biden was back in town last weekend. People were saying, let's do our Christmas shopping, and if we happen to see Joe, great. Nick Caggiano is owner of Nicola Pizza in Rehoboth. He first met Biden in 1972, during his first run for the Senate. Caggiano said Secret Service agents arrived to pick up takeout pizzas for the Bidens when they got into town on November 12th. Rita Sontag is a nurse who lives in nearby Bethany Beach. She went to Rehoboth last weekend to do some shopping. She then went for a walk at Cape Henlopen State Park, a nature area near the Bidens' home. She happened to see the couple as they rode bikes while surrounded by Secret Service agents. I thought at this point he'd be holed up and not going out in public, Sontag said. But then I was like, oh, there he is. As popular as Biden is locally, not everyone is a fan. At a nearby business called T-Shirt World, employee Sydney Dole said that the few Biden shirts the store offered were not especially popular. President Donald Trump, on the other hand, had his own section in the store, with different kinds of clothes, hats, and other things. Some of the Trump-related goods sold out. Dole said she hoped to one day see Biden around town, but her face lit up when asked what would happen if Trump bought a house in Rehoboth Beach, too. She and another employee agreed that the rural areas outside of Delaware's beach towns are full of country-loving people. If you ride out a bit, you see a lot more Trump signs, Dole said. I think having Trump here, it would be more exciting for a lot of people.
Country music star Dolly Parton is being celebrated in song for her $1 million donation to coronavirus vaccine research efforts. Boston, Massachusetts professor Ryan Cordell posted a video on Twitter of himself performing a rewritten version of Parton's famous song, Jolene. Vaccine is the name of the new version. It is a hit. Cordell's post received tens of thousands of views in just a few days since its posting. Parton's song is about a woman worried that she will lose her lover to Jolene, a desirable woman who can have any man she wants. Parton sings, Jolene, 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 I'm begging you, please don't take my man. Jolene, 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 please don't take him just because you can. Vaccine expresses a similar sense of longing, but for a very different object. Cordell sings, Vaccine, 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 vaccine. I'm begging of you, please go in my arm. Vaccine, 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 vaccine. Please just keep me safe from COVID harm. The gently humorous lyrics came from Gretchen McCulloch, a language expert and writer. She posted the words to Vaccine online and invited people to record it. Cordell accepted. I love that song. I love Dolly Parton, he told the Boston Globe on Tuesday. So I went and grabbed my guitar. Parton's gift to Nashville's Vanderbilt University Medical Center helped efforts by researchers to develop Moderna's experimental coronavirus vaccine. The drug company announced successful results for its vaccine this week. Cordell grew up listening to Parton's music and saw her sing at a show last year. He called that performance one of his favorite musical memories. So I was just thrilled to see this news that she had contributed to COVID vaccine research, he said. Cordell hopes medical workers enjoy his video of vaccine. He noted the intense pressure they are under. If they watched the video and it made them happy for a minute, he said, that's all I need. I'm Katie Weaver.
Today, we answer a question from a group of friends. They write, we are Yasmin, Kubra, Ikrit, Rukiye, and Nazla, and we are writing from Turkey. We would like to learn some idioms about friendship. Thank you. From Yasmin in Turkey. Dear Yasmin, thank you for writing to us. There are many idioms or sayings in English that we use when we want to describe relationships between and among friends. Here are a few to practice with your friends.
The idiom, through thick and thin, is used to define a friend who is loyal and supportive during bad times as well as good times. It most often describes a friendship that has been strong for a long time. Here are two examples.
John and Lisa have been friends through thick and thin. My best friend and I stayed together through thick and thin.
If two people are like two peas in a pod, it means that they get along very well. They are two very good friends, and they are very similar to each other.
I have never seen Lola and Camille argue. They're like two peas in a pod.
The saying, thick as thieves, means the same thing. Thieves have to be loyal to each other to avoid arrest. They share secret wrongdoing and the important goal of keeping it secret.
Some friends are especially sympathetic and easy to talk to. They are not judgmental or impatient. They are good at sharing our pain, which helps ease our pain. A friend like this is often called a shoulder to cry on. We can go to this person with a problem or sadness, and they provide comfort.
Alyssa is such a great shoulder to cry on.
To hit it off with someone means to immediately like or get along with someone. This usually happens the first time two people are meeting. They often share interests, goals, and beliefs. This can happen between friends or love interests.
Carmen and Isabel hit it off at the party and are going to a movie together today. Mike and I did not hit it off on our first date, but we are going to try once more. Thanks for the question from the friend group in Turkey. Hope it helps you all through thick and thin. And that's Ask a Teacher. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Greg Stockel.
Now, the VOA program, American Stories. Our story today is called A Piece of Red Calico. It was written by Frank Stockton. Stockton was a popular writer in the second half of the 19th century. He wrote a large number of stories for children and other stories for adults. His most famous work, The Lady or the Tiger, can also be heard in VOA Special English. Now, here is Steve Ember with Frank Stockton's A Piece of Red Calico.
I was going to town one morning when my wife gave me a little piece of red calico cloth. She asked me if I would have time during the day to buy her 2.5 meters of calico cloth like that. I told her that it would be no trouble at all. Putting the piece of brightly colored cloth in my pocket, I took the train to the city. During the day, I stopped in at a large store. I saw a man walking the floor and asked him where I could see some red calico. "This way, sir," and he led me up the store. "Miss Stone," said he to a young woman, "show this gentleman some red calico." "What kind of red do you want?" asked Miss Stone. I showed her the little piece of calico cloth that my wife had given me. She looked at it and gave it back to me. Then she took down a great roll of cloth and spread it out on the counter. "Why, that isn't the right kind of red," said I. "No, not exactly," said she, "but it looks nicer than your sample." "That may be," said I, "but you see, I want it to look like this piece. There is something already made of this kind of calico, which needs to be enlarged or fixed or something. I want some calico of the same shade." The girl made no answer, but took down another roll of cloth. "That's the right color," said she. "Yes," I answered. "But it is striped." "Stripes are worn more than anything else in calicos," said she. "Yes, but this isn't to be worn," I said. "It's for a piece of furniture, I think. At any rate, I want perfectly plain material to go with something already in use." "Well, I don't think you can find it perfectly plain unless you get turkey red," she said. "What is turkey red?" I asked. "Turkey red is perfectly plain in calicos," she answered. "Well, let me see some." "We haven't any turkey red calico left," she said, "but we have some very nice plain calicos in other colors." "I don't want any other color. I want cloth to go with this." "It's hard to find low-cost calico like that," she said, and so I left her. I next went into a store a few doors up the street. I gave a salesman my sample and asked, "Have you any calico like this?" "Yes, sir," said he, "third counter to the right." I went to the third counter to the right. A man there looked at my sample on both sides. Then he said, "We haven't any of this." "I was told you had," said I. "We had it, but we're out of it now. You'll get that from an upholsterer, someone who recovers furniture." I went across the street to the upholsterer's store. "Have you anything like this?" I asked. "No," said the man. "We haven't. Is it for furniture?" "Yes," I answered. "Then turkey red is what you want." "Is turkey red just like this?" I asked. "No," said he, "but it's much better." "That makes no difference to me," I said. "I want something just like this." "But they don't use that for furniture," he said. "I should think people could use anything they wanted for furniture," I said, somewhat sharply. "They can, but they don't," he said calmly. "They don't use red like that. They use turkey red." I said no more, but left. The next place I visited was a very large store. Of the first salesman I saw, I asked if they sold red calico like my sample. "You'll find that on the second floor," said he. I went up the steps. There, I asked the man, "Where will I find red calico?" "In the far room to the left, over there," and he pointed to a distant corner. I walked through the crowds of purchasers and salespeople, and around the counters and tables filled with goods, to the far room to the left. When I got there, I asked for red calico. "The second counter down this side," said the man. I went there and produced my sample. "Calicos are downstairs," said the man. "They told me they were up here," I said. "Not these plain goods. You'll find them downstairs at the back of the store over on that side." I went downstairs to the back of the store. "Where will I find red calico like this?" I asked.
"Next counter but one," said the man, walking with me in the direction he pointed out. "Dunn, show this man red calicos."
Mr. Dunn took my sample and looked at it. "We haven't this shade in that quality of goods," he said.
"Well, do you have it in any quality of goods?" I asked.
"Yes, we've got it finer."
And he took down a piece of calico and unrolled a meter or two of it on the counter.
"That's not this shade," I said.
"No," said he. "It is finer, and the color is better."
"I want it to match this," I said.
"I thought you didn't care about the match," said the salesman. "You said you didn't care for the quality of the goods. You know, you can't match goods unless you take into consideration quality and color both. If you want that quality of goods in red, you ought to get turkey red."
I did not think it necessary to answer this comment, but said, "Then you've got nothing like this."
"No, sir. But perhaps they may have it in the upholstery department on the sixth floor."
So I got in the elevator and went to the sixth floor. "Have you any red material like this?" I said to a young man.
"Red material? Upholstery department, other end of this floor."
I went to the other end of the floor. "I want some red calico," I said to a man.
"Furniture goods?" he asked.
"Yes," said I.
"Fourth counter to the left."
I went to the fourth counter to the left and showed my sample to a salesman. He looked at it and said,
"You'll get this down on the first floor, calico department."
I went down in the elevator and out on the street. I was completely sick of red calico, but I decided to make one more effort.
My wife had bought her red calico not long before, and there must be some to be had somewhere. I should have asked her where she got it, but I thought a simple little thing like that could be bought anywhere. I went into another large store. As I entered the door, a sudden nervousness took hold of me. I just could not take out that piece of red calico again. If I had had any other kind of cloth, I think I would have asked them if they could match that. But I stepped up to a young woman and presented my sample with the usual question. "Back room, counter on the left," she said. I went there. "Have you any red calico like this?" I asked the saleswoman. "No, sir," she said, "but we have it in turkey red." "Turkey red again!" I surrendered. "All right," I said, "give me turkey red." "How much, sir?" she asked. "I don't know, say 15 meters. She looked at me strangely, but measured off 15 meters of turkey red calico. Then she touched the counter and called out, "Cash." A young girl with yellow hair appeared. The woman wrote the number of meters, the name of the goods, her own number, the price, and the amount of money I gave her on a piece of paper. She probably wrote some other things, like the color of my eyes and the direction and speed of the wind. She then copied all this into a little book. Then she gave the piece of paper, the money, and the turkey red cloth to the yellow-haired girl. This girl copied the information into a little book she carried. Then she went away with the calico, the paper, and the money. After a very long time, the girl came back, bringing the money I was owed and the package of turkey red calico. I returned to my office, but had time for very little work the rest of the day. When I reached home, I gave the package of calico to my wife. She opened it and declared, "Why, this doesn't match the piece I gave you." "Match it," I cried. "Oh no, it doesn't match it. You didn't want that matched. You were mistaken. What you wanted was turkey red, third counter to the left." I mean, turkey red is what they use. My wife looked at me in surprise, and then I told her my troubles. "Well," said she, "this turkey red is much nicer looking than what I had. You've got so much of it that I don't have to use the other at all. I wish I had thought of turkey red before." "I wish, from the bottom of my heart, you had," said I.
A Piece of Red Calico was written by Frank Stockton. It was adapted by Shelley Gollist and produced by LaJuan Davis. Your storyteller was Steve Ember. I'm Bob Doty.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.